KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. My name is Mike Hagan. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's about 10 minutes after 11 p.m. on the 12th of February, and I apologize for the late start here. I had a little bit of technical difficulty with my MP3 player, as I've had over the last couple of weeks, so I'm going to have to do some sort of quick fix for the music that I was planning for this evening, but I think we'll have it worked out here in just a couple of minutes. So at any rate, it is Mike, and you are listening to Radio Orbit. We do this every Monday night from 11 p.m. until 2 a.m. in the morning, Central Time, and we do it for everybody everywhere. We broadcast the show on KOPN 89.5 FM in Columbia, Missouri, and we also stream the show from KOPN live on the web 24 hours a day as well. You can catch that stream at kopn.org on the web. You can also do it directly from my site at www.mikehagan.com. All right, quickly, tonight, Paul Laffoley. We're going to be talking about art, imagination, creativity, time travel, architecture, I'm not sure what else, music by the Bastard Fairies, if I can get it working, okay? Thanks to Debbie, Free Range Radio Theater. Great stuff as always, Kelvin and Jason. Before that, jazz plus blues. Tonight, I don't know, soft and slushy maybe. Tech Radio, always informative, helping us out with our technological gadgetry. Jeff Wheeler starting things off with Uncommon Light, 3 to 5 p.m. every Monday. Killer Radio on KOPN, your imagination station. Glad to be here with you tonight and a part of it all, okay? All right, thanks to everyone who listened last week and participated in the program. Thanks to John J. Harper. Great stuff from John, really doing a nice job of bringing a whole lot of ideas and disciplines and people together and adding his own insights as well. His book is called Transformers, Shamans of the 21st Century. It's well worth a look. We also heard the beautiful voice and words of Elise Brion. If you missed the show, it's all on the web, www.mikehagan.com, in the program archives, all right? Speaking of Elise, actually, I saw her on Friday night as she opened up, actually, for Noah Earle at the Blue Fugue. Tobias Epstein, my friend Toby, was also on the bill that night. Good music. Certainly great stuff going on from all of them. And, you know, Toby was on the program before, and Elise was on last Monday. And Noah Earle is going to be on the show, joining me live in the studio on March 5th when we talk with Ralph Metzner. So mark that one on your calendars, all right, for a couple of good reasons, all right? Two of them, Ralph Metzner and Noah Earle. All right, tonight, as I mentioned, artist extraordinaire Paul Laffoley, as gifted a painter as I've ever seen, absolutely visionary with regard to his subject matter, and absolutely remarkable and outrageous in the way he presents these topics. I urge all of you to get a leg up right now. Check him out on the web at Laffoley Archive. That's Laffoley, LaffoleyArchive.com. You'll get a taste of what I'm talking about and get to see some of the work that we'll be talking about with Paul in just a few minutes, okay? As I mentioned before, we've got some smart new music as well for people who are interested in that sort of thing. If I could get it to work, I'd play some of it for you. But so far, I haven't been able to figure that out. So I'll see what I can do at the next break or so with regard to the music, and then we'll try to get the Bastard Fairies for you as well tonight, okay? But in the meantime, all the music that gets featured on the program, whether I can play it or not, is on the web as well in my music archives, and there's great stuff coming up, all right? So stick with me. All right, one more thing. It is pledge drive time again. Time to plead for your support for this remarkable radio station and this program. And there are lots of reasons to support the station, but I hope for the listeners out there, you already know many of them. I'm not going to waste a whole lot of time on it tonight. We've got a really busy show planned, but I'm close to my goal for the drive. So please visit KOPN on the web at kopn.org and make a donation. Support commercial-free, independent, free-thinking radio. www.kopn.org. Do it, all right? Please, there are so few of us left, independent radio stations like this, so please help us out. Help us stay on the air, and, you know, we can't do it without you. So, all right, I'll shut it off here for a minute, and, well, actually, I was going to say I was going to play a song, but why do it? Because the music that I was so excited about playing, I haven't been able to get worked out, so I think we're just going to get right on to our guest. All right. His name is Paul Loffoli. He's an architect. He's a master painter, a visionary futurist. He's a map maker of hyperspace and a time traveler. For over 40 years, he's been creating works of extraordinary art in what he calls the Boston Visionary Cell. He's lived and worked in this space almost nonstop for the majority of his life. And here with us tonight from that same Boston Visionary Cell, the amazing Paul Loffoli. Paul, thank you so much. It's an absolute honor and a privilege to welcome you to Radio Orbit. How are you tonight?
Well, thank you. Feeling pretty well.
Well, it's 20 after midnight, actually. So we appreciate you sticking up with us tonight.
Sure.
And you and me are just going to jump into it here. And the way I'd like to start, I think, you know, people who aren't familiar with your work, if they were to see some of it, Paul, if they've got a pulse, I'm certain that they'd wonder where a guy like you comes from. So let's start out with some background, if you don't mind. Tell us a little bit about what led you on this path, and as much as you'd like, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born on August 14th, 1940, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the first word I spoke at 6 months was Constantinople. And then I didn't speak for 4 years. I was born late in my parents' life, and so my mother thought that there must be something wrong, so they took me to a psychologist at Harvard. And I was diagnosed as a high-functioning autistic child, which today they would define as having Asperger's syndrome. But since I didn't talk a lot, they said my IQ was between 76 and 79. But right after that, I began to speak, read, write, paint, you know, and I was homeschooled for a while by my mother.
Mm-hmm.
My father started to teach me Hatha yoga. He also gave me lectures in anti-gravity and the physics of consciousness. He actually never believed in gravity. he thought it was something else, like a push or I think now that it's probably similar to what Descartes was talking about is vortex theory.
René Descartes.
Yeah. And so I grew up thinking that gravity didn't exist. You know, when I hear other kids talking about it, I'd say, well, it doesn't exist. And, you know, and I went through some stuff with that. We went to Belmont, and that's where I lived most of my life. And so my parents wanted to send me to a prep school called Belmont Hill School. And the people there, the headmaster and the rest, said, well, you know, like, he's kind of stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And so my father, who had connections at Harvard University, I mean, he taught tax law there for a while. But he was a banker at the Cambridge Trust Company.
Right.
He said, well, I'm going to get a tutor. And so he met a Hindu of the Brahmin class who came from Madras, India. He was also a member of the Theosophical Society. I think that's how my father made the connection, because he did things like that, and he also did, he was a medium. And so...
Your father was a medium?
Yeah. Yeah. My grandfather used to trot him out at the place in it was called the Exeter Street Theater, but it was the first spiritualist church in the United States. You know, it's on the corner of Newbury Street and Exeter Street in Boston.
What, by spiritualist, what do you mean?
Well, a person that followed the idea that you could communicate with the dead. Certain people use that place as a resource, like William James,
right,
found Lenora Piper, the person that he considered to be the white crow, the person who was the exception to a lot of you know, phony mediums. And so there were whole sets of things like that. So anyway, I met I met Rustam Devitri, and he moved my IQ up to about 147. And so then he said that if he'd given some more time, he could have moved it up close to 200, but his father died and he had to return to India to be the head of the family.
Amazing.
In 1958, I entered Brown University, and my course advisor was recently from Cologne. He was not fully aware of the American University protocol.
From Cologne in Germany.
Yeah, right. Realizing immediately that I had a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to gorge myself on knowledge, I went for it almost against the university policy. I chose to start three separate majors in my freshman year, classics, art history, and philosophy, which was, to me, an excellent thing to do, because I noticed that every time I had lecture courses, I'd always fail them. And whereas that when I had a chance to talk, you know, to people, I was able to pass the courses or get A's in them.
Right, everybody learns in a different way, you know.
Yeah, well, we had primary texts, you know, not textbooks, but real books and heated discussions, and this would continue on into the middle of the night. And so finally, with all this activity, I suffered what people call an ordinary nervous breakdown. They gave me a psychiatrist, and he prescribed 8 electroshock treatments within a 2-month period to restore my energy so that I could graduate with honors. Because his explanation was that it wasn't like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, Ken Kesey's play,
sure.
That it didn't destroy people. It gave them a chance to have a rest that they normally do not have, because it brings you down below the REM cycle, and it's sort of like being placed in a medical coma. And as a result of that, I had a spring back into dreaming, you know, some amazing lucid dreams, which actually became one of the major sources of what I do. And I worked, and then I went to the Harvard Graduate School of Design. It was an uphill battle at best, and because at that time they were pushing people who worked for Le Corbusier and his work, and I was kind of interested in what was going on out west. I always liked Frank Lloyd Wright and Bruce Goff and people like that, and they said, "Well, those people had no social conscience, and what we have to do is, basically work on, taking care of mass housing."
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I started to come up with my idea for physically alive architecture, grafting vegetation together.
Yeah, that's something I want to talk about for sure. The idea of a plant home.
Yeah.
An amazing concept, actually.
Well, the thing is that my position was not just growing grass on the tops of roofs. I mean, there are so many architects that do that today under the rubric of green architecture. But to me, true green architecture is a house that's physically alive. And we're not yet at a place in science or history where we could have alternative living creatures, you know, like expanding a whale so huge you could live in it, like Jonah. But you can do things now with vegetation, especially using the ginkgo biloba tree. You know, that tree was around during the time of the dinosaurs. It's the oldest flowering plant on the planet.
Right, and it's come into like the medicinal realm in
It's a fantastic thing, and it was prevented from being extinct by some Chinese monks in the 19th century. They saved it, And now it proliferates as much as kudzu vine. And what it does is it allows you to graft conifer to deciduous trees, vegetables to fruits, grasses to vines, and all of these things together.
Hmm.
So I immediately figured that if you wanted real mass housing that wasn't simply something that the government would have to pay for, you know, like people who do mass housing projects always come down to the problem of who's going to pay for it. So it's and so it's not free housing, but what I'm proposing could actually be after a while a free house, because even though the first examples would be like vegetable chimera, meaning that you're putting together something that doesn't exist in nature. And the same, like we created the navel orange and some other things that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not a, that's something that you found in nature, but working with nature directly, we were able to create a fantastic fruit to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so my position was, if you could graft together a structure that you could live in, and you could get it to go to seed, then you would see if the seeds produced a like structure, and
mm-hmm.
then with a botanical engineer, you could start to do growth acceleration, so it wouldn't take 50 years to do the parts. Because if you take some pine trees and graft the branches and the sideways, and then you start using bamboo and kudzu vine and you create like forms like the Klein bottle. I've always liked that, and Mobius strip, because those are biological in their nature. Like the Klein bottle that people are interested in now is actually what we are as a conscious creature. You can take a right and a left-handed Mobius strip made out of copper.
Mm-hmm.
You can run an electromagnetic wavefront over them, and with a computer, you can bring them together and produce a Klein bottle, because if you sever a Klein bottle, you'd get a right and a left-handed or another just a single large Mobius strip.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the concept of the Mobius strip goes from the second to third dimension of spatiality, and the Klein bottle goes from the third to the fourth, because when the thing is, it looks like a trumpet that the end of it swings around and penetrates the side, and you identify the tip of the trumpet with the large opening at the other end. But when you pass through these surfaces, the only way that we can model it is by rupturing the surface. You know, like you see people try to make them out of glass, and they're connected together, so that's not really what it is.
Right.
It's because an electromagnetic wavefront can pass through each other without rupturing it. So that's basically what we are, and I think that's how consciousness actually arises, because consciousness is in every part of the universe, right? But it's in the atomic level, it's so slight and it appears so mechanical that you don't get the kind of richness our sense of experience.
Right, it expresses itself differently.
Yeah, right. And so that it comes up and it becomes what we are. But getting back to what I was saying is that to then have a person be given these special seeds and then plant them in places where you have land for very little money, like swamps,
mm-hmm.
would be perfect. Mm-hmm. People said, "Wow, what are you doing, making mosquito farms?" And I said, "No, I It turns out I have a cousin who's an entomologist.
Uh-huh.
So he told me all the tricks to prevent that kind of stuff.
Right.
But even though that it was, in other words, it's internally reasonable, they said, get out of here. You know, this the Harvard Graduate School of Design. So I was grand juried out for being over-involved in my work.
Right,
so I added, I said, is there a safe involvement level, like a safe suds level in a washing machine?
Hmm.
But that didn't help my case either.
I'm sure, but it's a valid question. You know, do you remember who Luther Burbank was?
Yes.
That's what it reminds me of when you're talking about this sort of reaching back evolutionarily with these plants and sort of creating new ones, but maybe not new, but old, you know?
Well, in London, at the the gardens there, they've been grafting vegetation for 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to make a special trip there and talk to people on how to do that kind of grafting.
That's remarkable. Look, Paul, let's take a little break here. We're sort of at the bottom of the hour. I got a couple things I got to take care of. I finally got my music working here. So we'll take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk some more, okay?
Great.
Everybody, wonderful stuff. Paul Lawfully, an amazing artist. He's an architect. He does a whole lot of things. And if you can get a look at his work, you will see exactly why we're going to spend as much time with him as we can tonight. On the web at Lawfully Archive. That's LAFFOLEY. LawfullyArchive.com. And also on the web on MySpace at myspace.com/PaulLawfully, LAFFOLEY, okay? All right, it's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit. It's KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. And we'll come back in just a minute with Paul Lawfully. Oh, yeah, the Bastard Fairies. There you go. Finally got things working. I'm glad I did. We'll hear more of them in just a little while here. It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, on the web at kopn.org. You can hear the live stream there as well. And we're also streaming on the web at cosmicwavesradio.com every Monday night. That song, by the way, off of the Bastard Fairies' most recent release, it's called Memento Mori. And that song was called A Venomous Tale. That's T-A-L-E, not T-A-I-L. Although, that would sort of work as well with this group of musicians. But anyway, okay, it's Mike, and we've got Paul Loffley, an amazing artist and a visionary futurist, a man who's done all kinds of outrageous work that I hope you get to take a look at on the web at loffoleyarchive.com. And you can also link directly over there from my site at mikehagan.com. But let's get right back to him here and say hello to Paul Loffley. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for sticking around with us here.
Sure.
Okay, look, I have a question about ancestors, sort of, and people whose work, you know, we all sort of take into our own lives and then express ourselves with their work. You make a great homage to so many different people through some of your pieces of art, and I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And
why I do that?
Certainly why, but also what the motivation for it is. I guess that really is why. But I mean, I think Friedrich Kiesler. I'd like you to talk about Kiesler because
yes, okay. I was just about to do that because my next thing was my uncle, who was an architect, gave me one piece of advice concerning my scholastic debacle. He said, no matter what you do, never have anything to do with Friedrich Kiesler. and I always considered him as an absolute source of inverse knowledge. So as soon as I heard that and saw his stuff, I was on a train to New York, and I wrote him 17 times to work for him, and he responded on the 17th.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, I said, why did it take me 17 letters of the same letter? He says, well, 17 is my number. And I said, I thought that you would understand that because you lived at 17 Taylor Road in Belmont. and it was a reference to the Baroque, you know, where they're, that finally from a one-point perspective, that our architects like Borromini and Bernini moved to 17 points of perspective in an interior.
Hmm.
So it was almost like a forecast of virtual reality now. Well, the thing is that while I was there, I worked for him at night, and he said he couldn't pay me much, so I needed to get a day job, and I needed to get some place to live. Because when I showed up with a suitcase at his door, you know, he said, you can't live here, but I wasn't doing that. I was just showing him some of my stuff. Marcel Duchamp actually did that.
Uh-huh.
Right? Oh, he came to New York earlier than Kiesler. That was 1912, and then Kiesler came in 1928. But he soon became part of the permanent avant-garde in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I also did cold calling prominent artists. You know, they're in magazines, and that's how I ended up meeting Andy Warhol and working for him also for a while.
When was that?
Huh?
When was that?
That was in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
And he still had his large studio that was up in Harlem. You know, it was in a firehouse that had been abandoned. He always had big places,
uh-huh,
so he could have lots of people, you know, hanging around him.
Wow, that's so cool because this was all before you sort of founded the Visionary Cell there in Boston.
Oh yeah, right, yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
But I'm saying what happened there is that he said, I'm going to have to do some work. You know, you can crash here, but you're going to have to help me out with something. So
right.
At first I thought I was going to be doing carpentry and plumbing and that sort of kind of stuff. He said, no, you're going to be watching television.
Huh.
And I said, okay. You know, thinking that I'm going to be watching reruns of Lucy until I went blind. But he said, no, since you're the new guy, you're going to be watching television from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Huh.
Now, during that time, you know, that's years ago now,
right.
They had test patterns. And so I was watching those things and taking notes. And then I began to realize I was watching what were really unconscious mandalas. Because I'd had some knowledge of it through Rustam Devitri and my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
What were test patterns, though, Paul, for people who didn't see TV back then?
Okay, a test pattern is like parts of say, the color spectrum.
Right, right. Stripes,
then they have X's, you know large diagonals of it, so that it extends across the screen,
mm-hmm.
and then circles and other things, so that they really do resemble what historically were called mandalas,
mm-hmm.
and so I kept talking about that, and I noticed Warhol wasn't really interested in that at all. So I picked up and then started using the mandalic structure in my own painting. But also that I discovered that I couldn't stay there unless I got an actual paying job. So I started going around to various architectural offices, and I went to 17. On the 17th, I was taken in by Emery Roth and Sons. At that time, it was on 2nd Avenue and 52nd Street.
New York City.
Yeah, New York City. And what they were doing is they were working on the World Trade Center.
72, is that when it was completed?
Well, it was, yeah.
But it began planning back in 63.
It actually began, it entered the office, I think in 1962.
Uh-huh.
Now Emery Roth and Sons in the trade is what is called a pencil, meaning that they don't do design. They simply accept the designs of big time designers that come in from other areas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that have buildings where the other person is the architect of record and that sort of thing.
Right.
And so they have a production staff. But they also had to have, just simply for show, a design group. So I'm going through this routine of saying, can you do this? Can you do that? And I said, and then the guy would say, no, you can't work here. So when I got to that place, I went through the same routine, and they said, okay, put them right in the design group. I said, wow. I'm not realizing what it is I'm going into.
Right.
But, So I'm in there for a while, and I'm not doing a thing. I'm just sitting at a drafting board, and so I go up to Mr. Gershon, my boss, and I said, what's happening? Why aren't I doing any work?
Right.
And he said, well, I want you to go back to your drafting board and think great thoughts. Now. That's almost like somebody talking from a comic book mind. I said, what are you talking about? But I went and did that. And eventually, Yamasaki showed up. This time.
Now, Yamasaki was.
Minoru Yamasaki.
Mm-hmm.
He showed up now with a model. Because up to this point, There were just these scatterings of plans, you know, that were being sent out and examined by engineers in the office and the like and that kind of stuff. But now the actual model showed up, and it was the most beautiful model I ever saw. You know, made where it was all plastic and made with those at that time it was made with tools that was scaled down, you know, like a buzzsaw. It was a little tiny thing, so that it was all the parts were perfectly aligned,
right.
But it was totally empty.
Huh.
And he was like so upset about the fact that the Sears Tower in Chicago was also on its way up, which was a eventually became higher.
Mm-hmm.
That he was concerned with making sure that they didn't get ahead of him, and so he just left this office to do one basic thing: connect the building into the infrastructure of New York, which meant that we had to design it, meaning we had to put the guts inside the thing.
Right.
And so I'm working along, and I was assigned floors 15 to 45 in Tower 2. And I began to realize immediately that as you had to have three banks of 18 elevators to get people to the top, it meant you ate into the space that they were renting very rapidly. So you were ending
right,
up...
The volume of the elevator shafts,
yeah,
et cetera.
So you're ending up with places, a corridor and some boiler rooms. When at that time, office landscaping, where you had an open thing where you could have focus groups and all that kind of stuff, was one of the reasons why he sold it as an idea, and it was going fast. And I said to myself, well, maybe if you build bridges every fifth level, you will then have rentable space on the flat. And this would help the structure, because I began to see some things that were going on there that were kind of dangerous. Like they were eliminating asbestos flocking because they wanted to fast track it, meaning they wanted to design and build simultaneously. And he was in a race to get it up.
Right, because of what was happening in Chicago.
Yeah.
At least partially, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But the other problem was at the ground level in the basement, they had to design something that they eventually called a bathtub, where they first sunk into the muck at the end, you know, down by Battery Park.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at a profile of New York, you see the granite block sticks out from the ground up near, say, the Cathedral of St. John. But as you go along the Central Park, it kind of levels out. But then when you get to Canal Street, drops down 75 feet. Because that whole area was an alluvial deposit,
mm-hmm,
of material from the East River and the Hudson River, and what happened is that they were when people first came to New York, they came in boats and they landed there and they made boat slips, and the inevitable occurred. They started throwing garbage overboard and then filled it up. So like in Boston, almost all of Boston is filled land. Because it used to be a series of little islands, like Beacon Hill's an island,
mm-hmm,
Fort Hill's an island, that kind of stuff. And so then they discovered that they were going to build this monstrous set of buildings on what was muck. And so they decided that they'd try bentonite. That's a colloidal clay that you can drill a hole into muck, and it'll hold it back enough before you throw in some concrete and some rebar,
right? You can set,
and then you can get piles,
mm-hmm,
that'll go down to that, and they made what they call a bathtub.
Wow.
Now that was part of the that was the main reason why the thing is up or went up, and so that this killed a lot of the construction time, where they were trying to hurry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they started doing things like, instead of welding steel together, they bolted it, and it turns out those were some of the reasons why it came down.
What did you think when that happened? Holy cow!
Well, I knew exactly why it did. I mean, people talk about Building 7 coming down at the same time. I knew why, because when I was there, there were these engineers from Saudi Arabia. That was actually part of the Ben Laban Construction Company.
Go figure.
Because Yamasaki had worked with them and, mm-hmm, and built them up.
Right, that's a huge billion-dollar construction,
yeah,
gang, by the way, yeah.
Right, and And they started in Arabia and worked for Yamasaki, who was doing all kinds of things like airports, schools, hospitals, doing very, very large projects. And so he just brought them over.
Uh-huh.
And so I see these guys, these swarthy looking guys walking around, and some of them were asking me, where would you put demolition devices?
Huh.
And I said, well, I'm not really an engineer, but I'm curious as to know why you put things in it to demolish it, and it isn't even built. It was so strange to me. And he said, well, that's the way things are going now. So in a certain sense, the reason why they came down is because the Leuven Construction Company knew exactly where all the
stress points,
the places were that they put demolition devices, because it, New York.
So you believe it was demolished? It was brought down.
Yeah, well, that in the early 60s and 70s in New York, buildings were going up and down. Like every 6 months, you go away and you come back, there's a new building.
So they built them with charges built into them.
Build it so that it would come down. And so those guys knew the whole story.
Hmm.
And so it was very, very easy for them to do that. So it actually came down from extreme capitalism, as wanting to do that. And so at the time that I said that we should put in these various walkways, bridges between the buildings, which would be welded into the middle structure and all that kind of stuff. So everybody in the office said, wow, yes, that's a good idea. The things will stay up better.
Right, yes.
And then they called up the liaison officer for the Yamasaki's office, and then the next day I got called into the office, and he said, you're fired, because Yamasaki said, what I want is a prism-pure visual vibration, in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
What he produced was an 11.
Mm.
11, of course, in numerology is the worst number. It's a number of destruction. I actually at that point left New York, because I had a big fight with Kiesler. He tried to kill me with a sculptor's mallet. Because of something that I did, he actually began to trust me, and he had me doing things like polishing his the patina on his environmental sculptures that were going into a major show at the Guggenheim.
Mm-hmm.
So one day I'm sitting there, he gave me the rags. I blame him, and I'm rubbing this thing, and suddenly. Yeah. Scratches start to appear, and I'm rubbing more. And this guy had his antenna out 24/7.
Right.
He was 4'10". He was a little tiny guy, and he comes running across his huge studio. He had a dance studio that was originally set up for Juilliard. He just got it as a place to work.
Sure.
So he comes running by in a thick German accent. He was Viennese. This is fast. It's unforgivable. and he's picking up this mallet and going after me. So I said, this loon is going to crack my skull. And so I run down the stairs, and like in New York, in those old buildings, they don't have any landings. It was up on the third floor, so I'm running as fast as I can go. This little guy coming right after me, and so I go out out the door, and it was at Union Square, and I went down in the subway, got my stuff, and took a plane out of there, and never looked back.
Paul, that's a great place to take a break. Okay, amazing story. Thank you so much. We'll be back in just a minute, okay? Everybody, Paul Lafoley on the web, www.lafoleyarchive.com. That's LafoleyArchive.com. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. On the web at KOPN.org, and you'll have 3 minutes and 7 seconds to go on over there to KOPN and give us a donation. Pledge Drive Week is upon us, and we need you to help us keep this tremendously cool radio station on the air. Okay, so I'd appreciate it. KOPN.org, and it'll make you feel good. All right, we don't ask for much. We ask for anything. And here's another one from the Bastard Fairies. This is the title track from their most recent release. It's called Memento Mori. Back in a minute, it's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit. Paul Laffley with us. Wonderful time. Stick around. Another good one there from the Bastard Fairies. That's the title track of that CD called Memento Mori. You can get that whole CD, by the way, on the web, available for download, artwork and everything, compliments of the band, at thebastardfairies.com. Great stuff, and independent music that's being shared with everybody out there. Super talented bunch of people, so thanks for the music, and we'll have a little bit more of that as we move through the program tonight, okay? It's Mike. You listen to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. By the way, that last song was for, I've been doing dedications of my own, you know, over the last month or so, something I'm trying to add to the program. But two people of note that were important to me and are important to me were Geronimo, the Native American leader, actually an Apache, who, you know, fought against the encroachment of the U.S. government on ancestral lands for many, many years. He actually died on February 17th, 1909. And Alfred North Whitehead was born on the same day in 1861. He was, of course, an English mathematician and a philosopher and somebody who wrote about philosophy of science and foundations of mathematics and, of course, did, authored the epic, you know, Principia Mathematica with Bertrand Russell, who we talked about a week or two ago. And he was real influential in the introduction of concepts like novelty and complexification and things we talk a lot about on this program. So to grandfathers Geronimo and Alfred North Whitehead, here's to you, okay? All right, and so back to our guest, Paul Laufele, wonderful artist and a creative genius, I have to say, out there in Boston. And we're fortunate to have him sticking around with us here late into the night on the East Coast. So, Paul, thanks again. How are you?
Good.
Good. Hey, lots of people asking about Buckminster Fuller, since we're talking about people who have been around and influenced us.
Well, after I got back to Boston, I went to see my architectural professor at Brown, William Jordy, and he said that I was working on the spot, you know, for where the World Trade Center was going up, was the place where Gaudi had planned to build a hotel in New York, and so I always remembered that. And then when finally it came time to do the memorial, I instantly proposed that. I went over to Spain and over to Barcelona and talked to the major architectural historian Juan Basagola, and he managed to get the King of Spain to write a letter of recommendation. So I thought I had a leg up in doing that, because it would have been what should have been there. And at the same time, Jordy said, well, I think you should have something to do with Fuller, because Fuller didn't die until 1983, I believe. And so I started talking to him about his geodesic sphere. And he once said that if it gets bigger, it gets stronger. I said, well, how about if you put it around the entire Earth? And he said, why would you do that? And I said, well, you want one around the moon and around the Earth and a physical connection, meaning that you'd have a double layer geodesic sphere around the Earth and around the moon, and then you could then create the link through the what are called Lagrange points of zero gravity all the way through. So you could build bridges into space, and what you would use,
and it looked like a barbell of sorts or something like that.
That's right. Yeah. But the thing is, it actually can work, because Kenneth Snelson, who is he's basically a sculptor of it, as well as a theoretician. And he met Fuller when he was a freshman at Black Mountain College in Asheville, North Carolina.
Right.
And at that time, Fuller had never produced any visuals. He was talking a good game of all kinds of stuff. And during the time between the freshman and sophomore year, Kenneth went home. He was an 18-year-old kid. So he goes home and he invents the first discontinuous compression structure, where people see it as sort of like sticks and wires, where they don't touch each other. And what it turns out is that structure has no deflection, meaning that it's not the same way that you build in relation to gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And that structure has its value, to my mind, in building things into space. And so you could build these enormously long towers that would all connect, and you'd have expansion joints and all the rest. And it all could be built out of fiberglass, which is now stronger than steel. And with the materials that we have on the Earth, that would work, because it's sand. And so we've got sand and water, and every time Landsat photographs are made around the Earth, all the deserts get bigger. So unless we're going to wipe out the Earth, we could take that material and build this structure, and then we'd have ways in which we could get back down into the earth all the precious minerals have been vaporized and sent up. I think there's now somebody is trying to have a contest or some kind of competition to figure out how to bring all that stuff back down to the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's necessary to refertilize the earth. That's the reason why the deserts have been growing. But if that could be combined with grafting plants around the earth, then you could actually produce a huge plant that surrounds the earth. Now, it would become stronger and stronger. It would resist things burning out from lightning and
right,
this kind of
right,
stuff.
Right. Oh no, this is my kind of stuff. You can't believe it. I mean, I'm a plant person. You may not know the show well, but I mean, this is a big topic of discussion on this program a lot, and I think that plants are one of our escape modules if we're going to get out of the cultural crisis that we're in the middle of.
Sure.
But anyway, I love this. Please continue.
Okay. Well, it's like that. I mean, plants can live in outer space. You know, like we get seeded by them.
Whole panspermia concept and all that kind of stuff. Right.
But the thing is that we can do this also to the moon, so we can increase the land, the real estate of the earth by doing this sort of stuff, and then going to other planets and doing the same thing. But here on the earth, we could create a gigantic spherical electrical waterfall. So we could have, like energy wherever we wanted it. I guess right now that NASA is planning on doing part of this in terms of developing an elevator to go to geostationary orbit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but in my plan, you don't have to go to that far. You can only go up about, say, like 12 miles where you have all of the precious minerals. And what you want to do is clean that air and bring that stuff back down to the earth. So you could almost use various vapor barriers and suck the stuff down and bring it back in the earth. Like we've eliminated all the copper about 50 miles down on the surface of the earth, for piping. We don't need that anymore.
Right.
So we could take all that copper and just stick it back in the earth. On the moon, there is water, and the reason why there is, it wasn't because Leonardo da Vinci said there was, but that we know now through radar scanning that there are 1,000-foot holes on the surface of the moon, and so over the millions of years those things have been in existence. That comets have been dropping down the holes, and they're ice, an ice ball.
Hmm.
And so for about 50 feet at the bottom, it's like solid ice. So no matter which way the sun hits, because the sun hits all surfaces of the moon, it's
right.
just not one side, so that it doesn't vaporize it. So that, because the gravity is 1/6 of what it is on the earth. And so if you did the geodetic sphere around and it stays in position almost by itself, like if you were to build a ring around the earth up a number of miles, the thing would start to form, it would be like part of an atmosphere. It would travel at the 1,000 miles an hour, anything that's place in geostationary orbit does.
Yeah, we'll move at that speed, right?
Yeah, and so that what we would have is a method to terraform other places that we go, and so it wouldn't be a condition of living in tin cans, for generations,
mm-hmm.
the way a lot of people have proposed. And that you could actually deal with gravity devices, because we're almost to the point where we can control gravity and increase it and decrease it in situations.
Mm-hmm.
And So I've been working on that as a scheme for years, and I noticed, as I said, that parts of it are starting to occur.
Hmm.
And I know it isn't because they know about me, but some people are starting to think in that direction. But yeah. they're trying to get part of it into existence in a very practical way. You know, like the Japanese are planning hotels there, and giving people commercial rocket rides and stuff.
So the
people want hardware stores in the sky that you can do it. now to build this thing. Another thing I was talking to Fuller about, I said I figure that if you use crystalline graphite wire, that's something that's actually made now. We know it's made of fullerons. It's the strongest substance in tension that we know of. And the buckyballs, you know, where you have an icosahedral pentagonal dodecahedron structure, you know, with 64 nodes, those things hold together, and they can go thousands of miles and still hold a payload. So that wherever you are on the Earth, you can start one of these things from geostationary orbit and drop down a section of the geodetic sphere. And you just wait until another country gets enough money to build their section next to it. So it isn't something that you have to put together in one day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the geodetic sphere is made in small sections that are structurally integral to themselves. They can just fit together. And so I think it's actually a very practical solution to all the stuff that people are talking about and how to fix the environment. I mean, we have from the Industrial Revolution, which in a sense was a masculine rape of the earth, the Gaia, we took the energy out of the earth and did all this stuff. Now we have to do something that's equally as huge, only in this other way to bring the earth back to where it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so by that time we could move on to other planets, and we've restored the earth.
Wow. We haven't mentioned or talked much about your actual artwork yet. Hold on a second, and we'll tell people where they can go to take a good look at it. First of all, there are two good places, lafoleyarchive.com, and then your friend Miguel has done a wonderful job of putting all this stuff together on the web, also at MySpace, myspace.com/PaulLafoley. Now, Paul, there's this one particular piece here that I'm looking at that's called Utopia, the suspension between the possible and the impossible.
Right, yeah.
And this relates to what we're talking about right now, maybe.
Okay. Well, I mean, Utopia as a concept has always been something that I've used. Like I had a Utopia study center in the form of Atlantis in the floating island, and then I would make paintings that were with diagrams of how it works, and it's basically the logarithmic spiral.
Is that the same as the golden spiral, the golden mean?
Yeah. Okay.
Please explain that to people who aren't familiar.
Okay, the logarithmic or the equiangular or the golden ratio is 0.382 to 0.618 of unity. It's not just rectangles like 1 is to 1.618.
Mm-hmm.
It has two parts of the proportion, and it's actually part of the mathematics of death, that when you mature, the relationships between, say, the flanges and your fingers, you know, from your navel to the ground at the top of your head,
mm-hmm.
you know, all have all of these things in it. A nautilus shell, utilizes aspects of the logarithmic spiral, but that's actually the hard part of it. So that it's the part that's actually dead. It's like bark of the tree.
Mm.
things like the sequoia trees. People think that they're 3,000 or 4,000 years old. No, they're actually 30 years old. In the way is the part that's actually alive in the center, where the various life-giving juices are going up and down.
Mm-hmm.
When those things die, it's just they fall over.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't die before it fell over. It just got so huge that it could no longer support its weight.
Right.
In that way. Okay, but that proportion that people often associate with life, it's like the number five or the pentacle, where you find the golden proportion is built into all the diagonals of a pentacle, mm-hmm. a five-pointed mm-hmm. star.
Right.
And they're all 0.382 is a small section, and 0.618 the large section. But those are non-repeating decimals. They're like pi, in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I thought was what people could use as part of the diagram of understanding the actual forces of utopia, because it has three vectors. It has a vector into a centroid because it's spiraling in. In other words, it's like if there's a breathing out of the universe, that's the Archimedes spiral, where its radii are simply doubled at every point,
right.
As opposed to a logarithmic spiral where it's an angle theta. So that means when you reach the cosmic periphery and you come back the other way, the only thing you can do is make an angle.
Hmm.
And so as you come in, you have a sense of moving to a circle. You have a sense of going directly into the center, and you also have a sense of coming out because you never actually get there. Because a logarithmic spiral makes an infinite number of revolutions around its focus, but never arrives. So having those three things, you can take the failed aspects of utopia apart. Like if you just have a situation where with everything's going in just a circle where it's the same all the time, that's what I would call kinetopia. Going directly in into the source, that's what I would call utopia, with a EU, the good place. But it's also that you have failed to respond to your social values. So it's like life lived in relation to the mystical experience, where you abdicate any connection to the rest of the world,
mm,
and then where the part that keeps on going out is cacotopia or like the bad place.
Mm.
So the true path of utopia is the logarithmic spiral that unites all of those three vectors in attention. So that's why people respond to it as such a dynamic form.
Respond to what?
To the shape,
mm.
to the topology of the form itself, and it's going back to an origin, so it's going back to a death place, but it's a way in which you can resolve the sense of the individual and the collective, which seems to most people to be an impossible thing to do. Like if you look at the history of intentional communities from the 19th century, when that stuff was first used in the United States from people like the Shakers and other religious groups that came over, that they would always have a situation where some part of it would fail, and although the Shakers I've noticed have always kept their eye on the future, where they were the first to have telephones and electric lights in their place before the the secular people around them.
Mm-hmm.
They took in unwanted children because they didn't have sex at all, so they never reproduced. But they would get their next generation of people from foundlings.
Yeah.
And that way, so they were extremely advanced, and I think there are an actual few these old ladies that still exist, like in Canterbury, New Hampshire, there's one, and at Harvard, Massachusetts, and out in Pittsfield in Western Massachusetts, there's a Shaker community. Where there are some people. I mean, most of them now it's just like a kind of living museum, you know, where tourists come and look at it. But they were the first, and they you know, became the models for places like Brook Farm in Roxbury, Massachusetts,
right,
where Nathaniel Hawthorne and others you know, got together. But they only had seven people in it. You know, and then they began to get on each other's nerves, and so in the 60s, you know, where they had all kinds of communes, like the first one was the Mel Lyman commune on Fort Hill in Boston. That's where I first saw a hippie, because that's where they started. It wasn't on the West Coast. It wasn't in Haight-Ashbury. It migrated from the east to the west. You know, it was almost like a recapitulation of the Conestoga wagon days.
That's amazing.
You know,
that sort of makes sense, though, too.
Yeah, because I remember some of my early mandalas were made into unlimited posters against my own better judgment, and were, you know, ended up all over the place. And so some guy came from the West Coast and he says, "I finally found the guy that you're ripping off." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And he said, "I saw these fantastic mandalas," and I said, "Oh, yeah, I see you have them in your studio." And I said, "Maybe if you took a closer look near the bottom at the name that's there," and it was with my name obviously on there,
right.
And the guy freaked out. It's because he believed that something new had to come from the West to go to the east.
Amazing. Well, look, I think we're bottom of the hour. Let's take another break here, okay?
Okay.
All right, excellent. We'll come back with Paul Laughley, everybody, on the web. Check out some of the work, and we'll come back. And hey, Paul, before we go to break, I want to mention something that you can think about while we're listening to a little music, okay? I want to talk about diagrams.
Sure.
Lots of your paintings look like diagrams.
And, they are diagrams.
Well, okay, then we'll talk about that, all right? We'll come back and do it with Paul Laughley on the web at Laughley Archive, LAFFOLEY, archive.com. And you can also link directly over to both of his sites from my place over at Mike Hagan, HAGAN.com. And, of course, KOPN on the web at KOPN.org. Once again, you'll have 4 minutes and 11 seconds to get on over there and show your support for wonderful radio. Where else are you going to get this sort of stuff, huh? The Bastard Fairies and Paul Laughley. And, of course, get Mike Hagan and Radio Orbit. Back in just a few minutes, it's Everyone Has a Secret, Ain't It the Truth?
I lost faith in myself. Everyone
The Bastard Fairies. That one is called Everyone Has a Secret. It's Mike. You're listening to Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM, about 12:35 now in the AM on the 13th of February. It's 1:30 AM in Boston, Massachusetts, where my guest is so courteously spending his time with us tonight. His name is Paul Laffoley. He's a wonderful artist, among many other things, and he's with us from the Boston Visionary Cell there on the Eastern Seaboard. Paul, hi.
Hi.
What's it like in Boston in your studio where you where you've spent so much time over
well,
these last?
The thing is, actually, I was evicted from that studio. I was there for 38 years, and they discovered that I was living there illegally.
How is that so? Tell us about how that even began.
Well, okay, I had another studio in Milton, Massachusetts, and the it was owned by a sculptor. It was a part of a farmhouse, and so he rented out half a barn. He had his studio in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
To another painter and myself had upstairs.
Right.
And so he would often have people come to see his work, but they would stay to see mine because I've discovered I had an outdoor place to do things. So I have some stuff out there. And so on one Christmas week of 1968, he says, "You're getting out of here." So he started throwing my paintings out in the snow, and I said, "Can you give me a break? You know, let me at least have a weekend to get out of here."
Right.
And he says, "Okay." So I wandered around in a total daze, and I wandered into the middle of Boston in the business district, and I went down Bromfield Street. And I remembered as a kid, my parents would bring me to this place called the Maliav restaurant that was like it was an Italian restaurant that began in Paris. And so they came to a place that had steps, so it looked like a little part of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was turning around in the street, you know, being a little nostalgic, and I saw this door at 36. And so I just walked in the door and up the stairs, and I saw an empty room with the door open. And so I asked somebody, you know, how could I rent this space?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Well, you have to go down to an office." And like 10 minutes later, I had it rented. And I was there. And when I first there, they were very, very liberal. As a matter of fact, it ended up after about 5 years. There were 27 people living there illegally.
This was still the late 60s, or
yeah, I mean it was starting in the 70s.
Okay,
you know?
Early 70s, all right.
And so they had a lot of dogs, and when you have dogs in one place, they all went wild. They formed a pack, and so they would not let customers that were going to the small businesses that were in there into the building. So they had a sweep, you know, and I missed that because I didn't have any pets or anything, so they thought I was okay. So I kept living there, and years went by, and I was doing all this stuff and everything. Last year, just about this time, they started to become antsy about me because, like, I started to have serious health problems. Mm. I had a leg amputated because I fell off a ladder.
I know, yes.
Yeah, and I'd get diabetes, you know. And so there were no handicap standards in this building. The place was a tax write-off.
Mm.
And so that's why they think they came down on me. So at the beginning of a lease period, they said, you're out of here. We know you've been living here. So then I went again into terminal spaz. But the miracle happened again as they found the place that I'm in now. And it's great. It's 62 feet long, 11 and a half feet high, 20 feet high, and it has a handicapped bathroom and a kitchen, you know, and the whole thing, and I have a view. In the other place, I had no view at all. It was like living in a dumpster.
Right? All right, well, cool. You're doing amazing work there, that's for sure. Let's talk about diagrams, okay?
Okay. Well, diagrams are essentially a way to deal visually with knowledge in the transdisciplinary form, so that it doesn't matter what you're thinking about, you can work with diagrams. Of course, the history of them, you know, just like from the Greek, to make lines, you have to go back to Hinduism because of mandala is a diagram. It's a diagram of a building where you lay it out on the ground and then you start building the thing up and then you've got a temple. So but it has a very complex situation. They got spirits living in them. You know, they got a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Western world, they've been the kind of sine qua non of science, because people think of diagrams as a way of presenting scientific information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the whole history of mathematics, physics, you can't do anything without using diagrams,
right?
But
usually, science, you know, the flow chart, right?
Right, but they're usually done in the way an amateur would do it, with chalk on a chalkboard, and so that the idea that these things could become art comes from the East and first hit our culture through the symbolists in the 19th century. Because when they brought over a tantric art, which is loaded with diagrams, at first they didn't know what to make of them, and then they actually began to influence Western artists, so that what people call modern abstract art is simply diagrams that were derived from Eastern religious diagrams.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I was hooked into that from birth, you know, through my father.
Right.
And so I began to think of them in relation to the things that I was thinking of as like pages of a book, because it cut through the publishing system, you know, like in the United States, it's a book actually is like a is in many people's minds defines something that's real or truthful or is true knowledge, and so if somebody has a book or something like that, you've got an instant authority. And so the protection against being published or by the publisher trying to make sure that they can sell the thing and all the rest of it, and then the academia works with books, so when people start working with paintings, it's easy to take an aesthetic distance from it and say, well, okay, well, that's a part of culture, but I don't have to really pay attention to it that much. Like even today, with our history of conceptual art, you go into what's called the meat market in New York at 560 West Broadway. There's 40 galleries in it. You could go up to the top and stay in the elevator, and when the elevator door opens, they have you see these galleries with the doors open. You can see the artwork in a second, and you get the whole thing. So it's very, very fast, and most New York art is, you can see it in an instant, because you're going, it's shopping, you know, like you're going into a place where you're looking at canned goods on the shelf, and you just want a quick look, and you want to pick what you have. So in any time that it takes any amount of time to look at a piece of artwork, a lot of people aren't going to do it. And so I said my strategy is to undercut the publishing business, so that each painting that I do is a large book page. You know, as if I'm making a monstrous thing, sort of like a medieval illumination.
Right.
Was the same deal. You know, they were the scribes.
Like a manuscript more. Right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Because the scribe, you know, they said they're going to do a Bible. You know, Lindisfarne's doing a Bible. 100 years.
Right.
So they get monks sitting on stools in the carrels. The guy dies, and they stick another monk in there, and they keep the thing going. And then finally they get it done, and then they go on to the next thing. But the power of a book, or that sense of authority of knowledge, is now what I'm trying to do is co-opt that, and move it into the gallery setting or the museum setting, instead of the way the people do. I mean, like
into a visual space too. Right?
Yes, right. Because we have people now that are incredibly visual with computers, and people look at my stuff and they say, well, this is done by a computer. and I remember one time I was hungry looking for jobs, so I went to New York and wanted to do some book illustration, and I'm showing them my stuff in various catalogs, and they said, this stuff is great. What's your program? And I said, what do you mean? It was, how did you do it? Well, it's paint on canvas. And I said, I've heard of pixel paint, not paint on canvas. You mean? And he said, yeah, it's 6 feet square,
well,
and I painted on the canvas. Just get out of here. We can't use this stuff. Because it has to be done instantly.
I tell you what, it is remarkable because the first time I saw your work, you know, the first thing is sort of, you know, the jaw drop, of course. But then when I realized that they were all essentially 6 foot square, and that's actually a question that's come up, and I'm going to ask you now because it's appropriate. Why 6 foot 1.5 inches? In other words, they're 73.5 inches square, not 72 inches.
Right. Okay. The thing is, I take 6 foot stretchers, and then in order to move them around, this is like the biggest square that I can do that's feasible. I mean, if I had a huge studio with some kind of a monstrous doors like an airplane hangar, I could do big ones. But then, of course, then you have the problem of where you can put them, and so you're doing mobile murals. So, but I find that the 6 foot square is bigger than the person, and it takes longer than one day. You know, because there's a lot of people that do a painting a day. So, like, they put it on the floor and slosh around a little bit, and then they do. The guy that used to be in the studio next to me at Bromfield Street would wait until 2 days before he'd have a show. And he'd work some stuff up, and then do that, and he'd go back to sleeping with his dog Pablo, you know, a huge Great Dane.
I have this theory that monkeys work best under pressure.
I guess that's a good idea. But anyway, because of in my horoscope, I have a fixed grand cross. I have I'm a Leo, in the 12th house Leo, and opposite in the 6th house is my moon in Aquarius, and then in the 3rd house I have Mars in Scorpio, and then in the 9th house I have Uranus in Taurus.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah, what?
I gotta tell you, you know, you were born August 14th.
Yeah.
I was born August 15th, 1964.
Wow. Leo's rule.
Anyway, I mean,
Warhol was a Leo. He was born on August 5th.
Who was that?
Warhol.
Oh, Andy Warhol was, really?
Yeah.
Wow, I got to add him to my calendar.
Right. but anyway, what I was going to say, the first time I had my chart done, the woman that did it didn't know anything about me.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, you're because you have a fixed grand cross, nothing's going on in your chart. So the only thing that's happening is in the 12th house, you have Neptune in 13 degrees, 26 minutes of Virgo. crossing into my ascendant, which is Virgo.
Uh-huh.
So that means that I'm able to take cosmic themes and turn them into finely detailed work.
Wow, ain't that the truth?
And and I was stunned, you know, because I didn't give her any hints at all what was going on.
Right.
But the thing is that I said I've been constantly fascinated by the way diagrams work. That this is what led me to the whole thing of dimensionality, you know, both temporality and spatiality.
Well, you're going to have to explain that a little bit more.
Okay. Well, I had started out doing some things about that. I mean, first I thought that dimensionality was actually part of mathematics. Well, I claim it's not. It's actually the dimensionality is really the new manifestation of fate. You know, like the Greeks had Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos, you know, weaving. You know, so they were making a matrix. You know, it was
a tapestry.
It was a female process with the looms and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so what you're looking for in dimensionality is the most comprehensive circumstances of existence itself. And I can't think of anything more comprehensive than a dimensional system. Now I've got an octave of spatiality and an octave of temporality, and the way that they connect is not the way that Einstein and Minkowski took three spatial dimensions and one temporal dimension, and then tried to reduce time to to some kind of a spatial cognate by the square root of minus one. I think that was exactly what Henri Bergson said, that they had simply spatialized time and they hadn't concerned themselves with a dimensional system that works for temporality. Like I have things like below time, you've got durance, succession, interval, and instant. And above time, you've got eternity, hypraxis, zeit, and metatime. And those things have to do with manifestations and possibilities opening up. An example in time, A causes B instead of circumstances C, with an abyss of transition between the cause and the effect. Now that's similar to like a black hole in spatiality. It's a natural singularity, and that allows energy that's efficacious without motion to connect to energy that's efficacious with motion. Because, like, if you're going to postulate eternity, which is part of temporality, it's something where a possibility gets manifested forever. In other words, it doesn't stop being manifested, so that it doesn't have the sense of motion that we experience with time.
Mm-hmm.
One possibility is possible within a moment of time, but if two people meet in a room, they have a world line, a history of back to back non reversible events, and so a conversation ensues because you can assess the possibility matrix of the person that you're talking to.
Okay.
And so what you can do to create an authentic interaction is to actualize a possibility that was logical for the other person who couldn't do it simply because existentially they didn't get to it.
Right,
so you
right.
do that and you go back and forth, so you're anticipating the anticipation of the anticipation of what it is, and that continues until one person gets bored. because they've moved beyond the other person's possibility matrix.
Right.
So that at the word the dimension of the hypraxis, which is an old French word for complete being, that you are literally filling. You're creating the fullness of being. You're all possibilities are being actualized. So that you're moving beyond a situation that you can experience as an individual. It's like the cells of our body, the intercellular communication system is the mystical experience for the body. And so that when Teilhard de Chardin
talked about the noosphere.
Huh?
You just read my mind. I was going to say, speaking of Frenchmen, what about Teilhard de Chardin and the noosphere and all this?
I have dedicated him to. He's the mentor of the Boston Visionary Cell. So the word is not SEL but CEL.
Huh.
You know, like each person that's involved in the thinking. Is a cell in the noosphere.
Mm-hmm. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, yeah.
Right.
All right, well, let's talk about the noosphere. We've got 5 minutes before a break, so let's talk a little bit about Chardin then and the noosphere, and maybe the omega point, you know?
Yeah, that working back from the omega point, his basic attitude was that union differentiates. In other words, that people usually think of the noosphere as like drops of water in an ocean. You know, where it all blends in.
Mm-hmm.
No, he said that the concept of a personality grows as you come closer to your immiscible self, meaning that it's like if you take two parts of a hyperbola and you're aiming it at a line. You know, like you have a baseline and a vertical. If you send the ends of the hyperbola up, they become asymptotic to each other.
Right.
They grow closer together, but the energy to do that has to grow with it. So there's a ferocity that occurs at the point of where they unite that can't be anticipated. When you're flatlining along below,
mm-hmm.
so that the cells of the noosphere is much more like Leibniz, you know the monads. That although he never talked about energy involved in the way that Teilhard did, because we didn't have a sense of energy until basically the 19th century. But actually, if you ask somebody what energy means, they'll say it was E. You know, it's just like a letter to them, and no sense of it. Or if they ever stick their fingers in a light socket, they'll get the energy of electricity.
Yeah, that's E.
But that's
right.
About the only definition that they have. This business of an alchemical coming together, which is what Teilhard was talking about
right.
in radial and tangential energy, the two of them uniting. So it's not something that is abstract at all. It's the most concrete in what he was proposing.
Do you think it's happening?
Of course it's happening.
I mean, do you think it's... Well, it's always happening, I guess.
Yeah.
But, I mean, do you think we're at a cusp?
That's the point. That's probably what 212 is all about, you know, in that way. It's not... in other words, we could blow ourselves up, or we could go through that... We could go through a social singularity and come out the other side.
Mm. Another French concept, the forward escape, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, he was French, right? And so am I. So I think that one of the interesting things about Teilhard is he actually didn't believe in extraterrestrials.
Hmm.
There was some note in a book that I read once that he had a private conversation that was recorded, and he just thought that there were people on the earth, and that was it.
That seems strange for a guy of his
scope. It really does. Well, everyone has a fatal flaw, and I think that was his.
Interesting.
Because, in other words, like as a priest, he had to hold on to the idea that Jesus came to the earth. He didn't come to Mars. He didn't go to Alpha Centauri. You know what I mean? So that, which would be a logical thing to do. You know, I mean, like if you're God running the universe, you'd want to check out all the areas that you did.
Right.
You know, what walk the edge of your land, as it were.
That's right.
So I think that he had a problem, and that's the reason why the church wouldn't publish the stuff while he was alive.
He was very controversial
in his day.
After
he died in 1955.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was sort of like Joachim of Fiora, I mean the Cistercian monk that influenced Dante, who lived between 1135 and 1202 A.D. and who produced a Christian worldview by dividing the Bible up into three parts: the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Book of Revelation.
Right.
So you had 12s in each one and that kind of stuff. Well, Teilhard had the same thing. In other words, he was being called onto the carpet, you know, with the Pope and you know, for heresy. And so finally they got him out of town. They went to China and stayed there for a while, and then he kept working. Le Comte de Nuit, who was a friend of his that because they both studied with Henri Bergson, and Le Comte de Nuit actually published first a book called Human Destiny, and in 1947, which had essentially the same ideas as Teilhard, only it wasn't as complex, and it didn't involve things like the shape of the earth, the topology of the earth, being important in how the noosphere would form, because people tend to think of something like that as although we're on a sphere, they don't think about that because it's so big that you still think of it topologically as flat.
Right. Paul, time for a little break, all right?
Okay. A little drink of water.
Yeah, take it and get a listen to this. It's a nice appropriate tune for the conversation. And we'll be back in just a few minutes. It's just a couple minutes after 1 o'clock with Paul Loffley on the air with me. It's Mike Hagan on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Once again, check us out on the web at kopn.org. You can listen to the live stream from the website there, and you can also donate a little bit of your hard-earned money to help keep community free-thinking, open-minded radio on the air in mid-Missouri and now around the world. All right, one more time, the Bastard Fairies. This one's called We're All Going to Hell.
Went to hell.
Beer. That was pretty good. Okay.
Oh, you Catholics wearing condoms, you are going to hell. All the fatties eating bonbons, we are going to hell. Unbaptized babies learn to limbo, purgatory's hell. And your religion is a gamble, and you are going to hell.
We're all going to hell. The Bastard Fairies on Radio Orbit, KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM. Great stuff. And we'll get back to more good stuff with Paul Loffoli. And now 2:05 in the AM. So, Paul, thanks so much for sticking around. I know it's real late,
though.
No.
Wide awake.
Good. Before we go any further, I want to mention the exhibit that's going on right now, Mind Physics. Tell people about it, all right?
Okay. It's at the Kent Gallery in the Chelsea part of New York at 541 West 25th Street. This is the final week. It started in January 4th and will end on February 17th. And people think it's a mini retrospective, but it's thematically related to mind physics. And so if you're in the New York area, drop in. You know, the place is open between probably like 11 and 6 each day. And I'll be grateful for your attendance.
Yeah, and I'd love to see it myself, and I'm sure anybody else out there who gets a load of this stuff would love to. You know, it's so difficult to appreciate the work itself when you're looking at it on a computer screen, and you know it's 6 inches square as opposed to 6 feet. And there are actually, I think, a couple of my favorite images that are up on the website are actually images of you standing in the gallery, because then you get a perspective of how big the actual artworks are, and they're beautiful. And you know, as I say that, it moves me to my, well, really wasn't my next question, but it's certainly one that I have to get to, so I'm going to take my cue from the image, okay? And in fact, I guess it's a reasonable segue, because we were talking about diagrams before. You have this one painting that I actually have posted up on my website that I chose to put on the front page there. It's called Thanaton, and this is, I guess it's sort of a diagram, but it's also not really a diagram. It's also sort of a thing in and of itself. Maybe you could talk about that, because that's that painting of it alone we could probably talk about for a long time.
Well, it's my best flying saucer painting.
My gosh, this is outrageous, you guys. If you haven't seen it, go look at Thanaton while we're at it, okay, everybody?
How that functions, like when I was 7 years old, the guy that came to do our bushes in Belmont started telling me that he was taken up in a flying saucer 17 times. He came from Belmonte, Italy, which is a suburb of Naples.
And you were in Boston still at this time, or
no, in Belmont.
Oh, okay.
No. I'm saying that this guy that came to do our bushes, you know, each year. I mean, the first time he came, he started in talking about that. And so I became fascinated with flying saucers right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was 11, I saw the opening of The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Sure, amazing.
You know, like with
Val Thor, right?
Right,
that whole story.
Klaatu and
Yeah, Klaatu. yeah, that was great.
And Gordon and the whole business.
Hey, as a quick left turn, did you ever read Jung's book, Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Sky?
The person that Jung talks about in his afterword was Orfeo Angelucci.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this person, who was named Giuseppe Conti, actually gave me a first edition signed of Orfeo Angelucci. It's like one of my sacred texts.
Wow.
Because Jung considered it an entirely structured religion in one book, of the new notion of seeing a mandor in the sky,
mm-hmm.
in the way it was.
Right.
But that I don't think he ever came to a conclusion as to whether they were real or not. But he was just saying that this was an archetypal image. But I found out that they were real through Giuseppe, because when I was like 15, he said, "I'm going away now, and I'm never coming back again. But I'm going to give you something that they gave me," and referring to these extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a medal that had a Star of David, and inside the Star of David in that space in the center, it had the swastika.
Hmm.
And then it had a reverse thing on each side, and he said that unless these two forces are united, we'll never come back. And so when I showed it to my parents, they said, "Oh, that's some kind of Nazi propaganda." The thing is, I kept it because of one thing: is that Giuseppe took a pin and he stuck it through the metal. Now it parted, and they could put a string through and then pull it out, and it would heal up. And it was extremely light. In 1947, this was the year that they used magnesium for lawnmowers, so I thought that was the lightest metal I've ever heard. But this was about 3 inches in diameter, and it was kind of thick, maybe a quarter of an inch thick. So when he handed it to me in my palm, I thought this thing was going to weigh a lot. Like it was brass, but it wasn't. So, your hand lifts up when you have an anticipation of a heavy weight. And so I did keep that. And the first time I went to Europe, I ended up in walking along the boulevard Saint Germain, and I went to that famous cafe, Le Deux Magots, the two monkeys, and I was sitting there, and on a little, one of those little tables that are 18 inches in diameter, and I ordered a Coke and an apricot tart, and I was sitting there. This was after I'd been kicked out of architectural school.
Right.
And I didn't realize I had this in my suitcase. That's where I hid it. I was going to walk down by the Ecole des Beaux-Arts and throw the thing, give the Ecole des Beaux-Arts an Italian salute and throw the medal in into the Seine.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the distance, in one direction, I could see the Eiffel Tower in the distance, and then in the other direction, I saw this guy coming along, who was dressed like an Apache, with the beret and the horizontal striped shirt and the bell bottoms and that kind of stuff with a side bag, and so he sees me wearing that around my neck, and. So he comes up and he says, "I'm a stringer for Figaro and Paris Match."
Uh huh.
And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, I want to write something about you." And I said, "What are you talking about?" So you're an American in Paris. And I said, "Well, isn't there a song and a movie about that? what's going on here? And he said, what do you do? And I said, I've just been kicked out of architectural school. And he said, oh, don't worry about that. I'm going to write a series of articles. You'll have commissions for the rest of your life.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm starting to buy this,
right?
Because when I ordered the Coke, the waiter, because he knew I was a naive American, had spiked it with absinthe.
Oh my God!
And so I was starting to feel pretty good. You know when you take a hit of absinthe, it's really smooth going down, and then suddenly like there's a loving rush at the other end.
And
so then I was feeling pretty good, and I start, you know, giving this guy my life story over right in front of him.
Sure.
And then he said, well, what's that that's hanging around your neck? And so I started to talk about it. And all the things and Giuseppe and all that kind of stuff, and he got really antsy, and so he got up and he grabbed it, he just yanked it off my neck, and started to run down the street, and it turns out that was Claude Vigileron, who started the Rail Society later on.
Sure.
And he told people that he went up a mountain in the middle of France, you know, and did the same thing.
That's great.
And I found out about that because we both appeared in a thing called Kook's Anthology that was written by Donna Cossey. In 1994.
Kook's Anthology.
Yeah, right. If you've never seen it, it's really good.
Oh Lord.
And so I was amazed. I
How
this
funny,
guy
Paul.
Had manufactured it right out of what what I said.
I'll tell you what.
But the thing is that I kept doing things on flying saucers, and I did early paintings, and then finally I wanted to do the big one. And so that in 1987, I was doing something for First Night in Boston. First Night is a celebration where artists work on on New Year's Eve,
right.
You know, outdoors. We actually, for some reason or other, it's become so pretentious that we franchise it to other cities.
Yeah, they do it all over the place. They do it here in Columbia, Missouri, believe it or not.
Right, yeah. But it all started here, mm-hmm. About 30 years ago.
All right.
And so one time I was doing my flying saucer thing, and I had figured out how to levitate the flying saucer through eddy currents. And so I was giving lectures on it. And it was being done on a prominent place on Boylston Street, in front of a huge building that had a big like entry foyer. So I was able to get a lot of people around me, and during the time, a friend of mine was taking pictures of me without a flash, just walking around and continually taking pictures. And one of the pictures that he took showed a white substance from the top of my head down to to like the spine.
Right.
It was covered, and people checked that thing out, and they couldn't figure out what that was. Somebody said, well, that's. They were flying over and just saying hello, and so that gave me the idea, and I put that image in the painting.
And this,
so I wanted to collect all the thoughts about that into that one painting.
Wow, amazing! And when you actually connect with the painting, there are two places where you put your hands.
That's right.
And something happens when you do that. In other words, that's what I meant when I said it's actually not just diagram. It's actually a device in and of itself.
It's an interactive. Well, the thing is, I don't believe the diagrams are abstract. I mean, I think they're completely concrete.
Yeah, but you have to
so
build them.
That the connection to them become concrete. That's why magic is real because you're using diagrams in a concrete way, not in an abstract way. You know, when people show books of diagrams and ancient things and this kind of stuff, you take an aesthetic distance from it. So that you are not actually involving yourself psychotronically. In other words, there's no mind physics. You're blocking the possibility of an interaction between a type of a topology and your own mind to build up an energy. I mean, like I also belong to the United States Psychotronic Association, where since 1975, people have been researching what people would call electronic voodoo dolls, but they actually work. Like you can de-infest a field of insects by taking a picture of the field, from an airplane, putting it in the device, working with it yourself, and the next day you go back, all the insects are dead. You know, and that
Man,
kind
it
of
sounds like Wilhelm Reich or something.
Huh?
It sounds like Wilhelm Reich or something.
Wilhelm Reich's
Orgone energy,
which is meta energy. That's really what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's energy that's efficacious without motion that can be transduced into energy that's efficacious with motion. So I call that Kato energy. So they're placing your hands on the alien's hands. You can actually get some information, and people have gotten ideas that I didn't anticipate, from it.
Right, and when you use it yourself, has it inspired you in any certain way, or?
It helped me do a.
As if you needed it, a
séance with Nikola Tesla.
Oh Lord, I love Nikola. He's one of my great old spirit guides, or something.
Okay, well here's my scoop on him. Is that when disinfo.com, it was run by Richard Metzger.
Sure, I know him.
You know him then?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
That's a great website, and they've actually got a couple of videos of Paul's over there at Disinfo.
Yeah.
Go on, please.
In 2000, he set up a big lecture series and panel discussions at the Hammerstein Ballroom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right next to that is the New Yorker Hotel, and that's where they were having the participants stay. Now, I said, is anybody rented the room that Tesla died in, room 327? He always stayed in a place that was divisible by three. and another thing with the 17 is that whenever he'd go to eat, he'd wipe his... the utensils 17 times with a napkin before he'd actually eat with them.
Oh my God!
But anyway, so I went in and stayed in there, and as the conference was going on, I said, I got to do something with this, and,
right.
And so I said, let's have a séance in the Tesla's last abode. He was penniless. So somebody gave him the money to stay there, and they gave him a small room. And the interesting thing is that when you looked out the window, you saw the Empire State Building. Now, the Empire State Building was the first place that the Waldorf was located. This was in the 19th century. You had across 34th Street, you had Madison Square Gardens, where the New York 400, the richest families, would gather, to exchange this, that, and the next thing.
Sure.
You know, you had the girl in the red velvet swing, that Stanford White designed, and Harry Potter shot him, and the whole bit. But at the other end of 34th Street was the Waldorf, where the hoi polloi could mix with the 400. They would come down to the other end, meaning that they were, somebody getting off the boat going by the Statue of Liberty and the Ellis Island, they would go down there and sit in the lobby and then connect with these very wealthy Americans. So if they had any talent, they could immediately get worked into something, because Tesla came over first with some letter and a quarter to see Edison, and Edison basically used them and kicked them for a field goal. So the first thing he did is he went to the to the Waldorf, and so that's where he met Westinghouse and all the rest of those guys, and so I figured that he wanted that room so he could see the same site. His heyday was involved, his seven fortunes I think he made over his lifetime and lost every one of them, but it's got to be some energy in that particular room, and I found out that in the revamping of the hotel, they did not mess around with his room, so it actually was his final resting place,
mm-hmm.
and so I said, let's do a seance where we ask him what was he thinking of in the last 10 years of his life.
Wow.
Where people thought he was just going to Bryant Park, picking up wounded pigeons and making little cages.
Right, as if that's the way he's going to finish his life.
Yeah, right. So I got a lot of people, like Bob Dobbs and Adam Pofrey, in the room, and we did we actually started out doing like a communion, because he lived on milk and Ritz crackers. So I gave everybody like a host of a Ritz cracker and have them drink a bit of milk as we were going around.
You're killing me. Oh my God.
And so then I lay on the bed because I had to cover all of the windows and everything to get it dark and stuff like that.
Yes,
and
yes.
So Adam Pofrey hypnotized me because I was not like my father, who was able to go into it in a second. I have to be hypnotized into doing it. And what came out was a line of clothing, all composed of vacuums and zero point energy, because he wanted to do things like to walk under the ocean on the ocean floor without a diving suit,
right.
Something because like when you see people that illustrate extraterrestrials coming to the Earth, they're not wearing those stupid diving suits, to go to the moon and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Von Doniggan claimed was the reason why all the things that he showed looked like somebody wearing diving suits. That they must have this other thing, because we have various types of vacuums. Where they get finer and finer, and the speed of light goes beyond the 300,000 kilometers per second.
Mm.
That people talk about as the speed of light, because you go into other areas, so that you're getting into other types of energy, and so this would be, in a certain sense, to people's minds that would be the emperor's clothes.
Mm.
Because it wouldn't look like you were wearing anything.
Right.
But the way that it was being described is that they could actually work.
Mm.
And we know very little about vacuums, except for, we put, tea and coffee in these vacuum canisters, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that to be able to have a suit that was composed of a vacuum that had its own skin,
mm-hmm.
that was completely invisible, that could go close to your own skin and move out from it, like an aura almost. Mm-hmm. So he was describing it as similar to utilizing the energy of your natural aura, which I thought made a lot of sense, and so that you when you see diagrams of auras. Some of them are quite large, and they start to move away from simply being looking like a humanoid and become more amorphous.
You know, Paul, in a larger sense, it sort of also reminds me of the ideas of Chardin, of this sort of a way to live in the imagination. You know, I mean, it's sort of like Tesla was struggling to give us a way to do that.
Oh, yeah. Because the imagination is the only thing we've got. That it's a survival mechanism. It's the reason why amateurs lead the way, because it's the love of knowledge. That's what the word amateur means, as opposed to professionalizing something where you're subject to an authority symbol. Like folk art, outsider art, all that kind of stuff. People are interested in it because we are covered with all kinds of rules. I mean, with such a litigious society, where people are afraid to step outside the door, or defend their own house, for afraid the court's going to turn around and put them in jail for doing that. So that's why I think that's what that means.
Okay, all right. Look, bottom of the hour. Okay.
Okay.
We got about 5 minutes, and then we'll come back. We'll have about another 25 or so, and we'll finish things up. But we've got a list of things. We've got plenty to talk about, Paul. I mean, I could talk to you for hours. Unfortunately, it's amazing because for months there was the shift that took on after mine, right, at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And went on until 5:30 in the morning or whatever, and no one would ever show up for it. And so when I wanted to, I could just sort of keep going. But unfortunately, well, not for her, but for me and you, we're going to have to stop at 2 o'clock because we do have a person that's going to take over then and do another show. So we'll get on with things real quick here. But I know you need to take a break and have a little sip of water or something. I need to do the same. And we'll come back and talk to everybody for a few more minutes, okay?
Okay.
Paul, thanks so much. Back in a minute, everybody. Paul Loffoli, wonderful stuff. The amazing, amazing Paul Loffoli. Check him out on the web, Paul Loffoli at Loffoli Archive. com, and also at myspace.com/Paul Loffoli. You can link there from here on out as well at my site, of course, at Mike Hagan, H-A-G-A-N. I can't even spell my own name at this point, H-A-G-A-N.com. And like I say, 5 minutes now, everybody, KOPN.org. Get over there, make a pledge, and support this incredible radio. Okay? This is The Bastard Fairies. The CD is available in its entirety at thebastardfairies.com, and this is a song called Habitual Inmate.
Thank you.
Habitual Inmate from Memento Mori. The Bastard Fairies, KOPN Columbia Radio Orbit. It's Mike Hagan. It is about 1:37 now in the a.m. on the 12th, actually 13th of February, and we're live on the air with Paul Loffoli from Boston, Massachusetts, and we've had a wonderful conversation for going on two and a half hours now, and we're going to continue. And, Paul, before we get anywhere else, we have to talk about time and time travel and time machines.
All right. About 1975, I got an idea that just came into my head, and I called it the level gyre. It's a new form of a gyroscope. Normally, a gyroscope has a precessional axis that tracks two masses, like a star in the center of the Earth, and then it has a single torque axis. So this thing came to me as a series of nested shells in which the precessional axis was fragmented and redistributed in space in the form of two interlocking three-dimensional equiangular spirals. And at the torque axes, now you would run a laser beam in a fiber optic bed, and in between the shells, you'd have a substance called ferrofluidics. That's a ferric compound ground finer than pumice that acts like almost an electrical wire,
mm-hmm.
but it's actually a liquid. It's very thick, and you can fire the thing from outside with radio frequency generators, and so you have a torque transfer inward. So it's not like a normal gyroscope where the maximum momentum is at the periphery and then it grows smaller and smaller as it moves towards the centroid.
Right, right, right.
It's the other way. In other words,
opposite,
because of the geometry of it. It moves towards the center and the velocity increases.
Okay.
So what you're doing is actually pressing at the speed of light. Well, we now know that the speed of light is not as sacrosanct as Einstein and Minkowski
thought it was,
defined.
Yeah,
so
stories all the time now, every day, about speeding it up. Well, actually, slowing it down, I guess, are the big ones that
we talk
about.
Yeah, there's a lady physicist at Harvard that reduced the speed of light down to 17 miles an hour,
right.
And that was 5 years ago, and I think she's got it down to 4, so that people can grab light.
Right.
Directly.
Grab a photon. Look at it.
Yeah.
How about the new lady running Harvard? Her name is Faust, by the way. Anyway, so go on.
In other words, this is part of this device that I've worked out, and it's based on, again, a psychotronic interaction. It's the idea that time travel is really... like retro and pre-perception. So it's pre-perception of the future and retro-perception
of
the past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that if you can extend those beyond your own death and prior to your own birth, you can then access information without being involved in any of the paradoxes that people talk about with time travel. If you go in the past, you're going to mess it up, and you're not getting information. But people who have that capacity, and it's a definable paranormal phenomenon. So I figured, is there a way to make that viable and enhance it so that anyone can do it? So if people are watching the image at the top of the diagram is a 7-mile cube that's in geostationary orbit, and then coming down from that are wires that crystalline graphite wires that connect to the surface of the Earth at Thule, Greenland, which is about 11 degrees away from the geometric North Pole, where all the isogogic lines converge. So you have a place of neutral magnetism, and so that's where the person operates it. And how you start to operate it is by using what I call the monitor. The monitor is simply the Wheatstone bridge that was invented by Dr. Wheatstone in the 19th century to test resistors. If you had 3 resistors of known ohmage, and then you put in the circuit another one, and you had a galvanometer across the part of the bridge, if it read 0, it meant that they were equal. And you can then substitute neon bulbs for the galvanometer, and you can run them up and down a person's chakra. Chakras and figure out what's going on for every activity. And in other words, every time you have some behavior that your chakras reach a certain frequency, and whether some of them may be off or are on periodically or go in cycles, so that you can take people who can do pre and retrocognition and then test what their profile is. And so then, what you want to do is to create a chakra inducer. So up in the sky is this place that has 7 pendulums and the 7 basic chakras, all made out of cholesterol, because we're basically composed of cholesterol. So the cholesterol isn't as bad as the doctors try to claim. We'd die if we didn't have it. And that what you're doing is getting the profile of somebody who is highly talented in pre and retrocognition, and then getting the characteristics working in this device so you can induce it in people who said they have no capacity for this. It involves some highly speculative notions like taking a neutron star and crushing it into the form of a Klein bottle and taking helium, which never reduces into a solid but remains in a plasmic state, to run through this star Klein bottle to act like the main oscillator as to how the thing works, and that's even higher than the device. It's up about another 24,000 miles up. But this one is called the Time Machine from the Earth, meaning it's taking the frame of reference of the Earth in relation to its geostationary orbit. It's the same type of thing, which has an exact distance as the distance when you get down to the atomic level and you find you have the Heisenberg's principle of indeterminacy. Right. When you reach a certain distance from an electron, you can't automatically know the velocity, the position of the electron. So that's a frame of reference. So when people talk about frame of references, it's usually still coming out of the 19th century without exact numbers connected to it. So in the story by H.G. Wells, you have some kind of a car, you know, which in Back to the Future they turned into a DeLorean, and that which meant that you could alter the entire universe for a single location. This, I think, is the flaw in the story, and the reason why people have bought the notion that you can screw the past up if you visit it, because that you can do it in your mind. I mean that say pre and retrocognition absorbs lucid dreaming. It absorbs a near death experience. It absorbs all those extreme forms of consciousness, which are that seem separated. So I'm trying to show that if they all work together, you can actually observe and not participate in, but simply observe future events and past events in terms of its event facts and the sensibility. So this is not based on science fiction. I mean, science fiction, which to my mind died in 1955 when Robert Heinlein first started to write Stranger in a Strange Land. Afterwards, you have science fiction that is ad hoc research and development for companies.
Right, right.
You know, the way NASA picked up Star Trek, you know, like the cell phone is the communicator.
Right, right.
You know,
right,
that kind of stuff.
Right.
So that what's going on is to get your mind to collect all these things and induce all these activities so that you can process information, not actual in other words, you probably can't touch things, but maybe that will be overcome as we move into a world where we duplicate ourselves through computers and that sort of thing, but that we will connect. You know, like VR is almost there. You know, where you're putting this thing in, and then you're looking through, and you're actually seeing the authentically new from a device that somebody invented.
Right.
And so the authentically new is, or the authentically old, which is different than history, because history is like the imaginative reconstruction of the past, and you can keep going over the same ground, but you may never actually know what went on, because you don't experience the sensibility, meaning you don't experience the world view or the cross sections of the worldview, which is where I use the word zeitgeist, the time spirit.
Mm.
So that you've got something that's going through the whole and in other words, you can process the entire universe through your mind.
Okay.
Only you learn the way to deal with the scientific notion of learning how things work, or what it would seem to be like talking about the mechanical parts, or the things that we've externalized into technology, that we can take all of that technology and bring it back into our mind. You know, like when people first had the bands around your head and you do alpha, and that kind of stuff. Eventually, you were able to throw the device away.
Right.
So that the to me, there's no such thing as time traveling. You travel through space,
right.
But you endure through time, and so we have to have a whole new nomenclature to describe this. And I think that once this thing actually exists, it'll be a precursor to a type of device that we can't imagine what it would be now, and that so that we're still working off of stuff from the 19th century, and thinking that's science fiction. I mean, the last time we had real science fiction was Jules Verne, who pinpointed almost up to 3 miles the location in Florida where a rocket would go up, you know, from the Earth to the Moon. You, you know, these guys built a huge gun. They dug it down and shot it to the moon.
Right.
It was 3 miles away from Cape Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Now here is that's what I call science fiction, because you had no concern for anything except for the future.
Right.
You know, so a science fiction writer is not really interested in whether they're predicting any facts. Whereas that, I think what's going on now is the actual predicting of facts and sensibilities.
Amazing. All right, 2012. Does this tie into it, or is that just hype?
No, it's like I would think that the 2013 will be our first time travel episode.
Wow.
The thing is that almost immediately, there'll be people who will be time controllers, because you can imagine that immediately you open up an enormous world.
No, I mean it's everything.
You could build structures that are light years in extent.
Not only that, you can have an address here. You can have an address not only in space but also in time, and you can have multiple.
You got
ones.
It. Right. That's only a little bit of it. We don't have time to
do a
full explanation of it right there. Yeah.
What about what's your position on psychedelics?
Well, I never tried them, although people try to force them down my throat. And I think because I have Neptune in the 12th house, I figured that's an addiction sign. that if I did that, I'd probably have bad trips and die.
Well, I think that your life and your experience and the product of it is purely psychedelic, which is ironic and fascinating at the same time. But for me, as a person who's sort of a psychedelic person, I'm absolutely fascinated by it, and I think it's encouraging, frankly, and fascinating, and a whole bunch of other things. What about your film Odyssey?
Well, they're still working on it. They're hopefully going to get it into Sundance, in the next season.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a wonderful film festival here in Colombia called the True False Film Festival that I may have to talk with you about off the air, about maybe trying to get it involved down here.
That would be great. Yeah.
All right.
Well, I was going to just say something more about.
Please.
I was the last person to talk to Timothy Leary. Because Greg Escalante, who's the curator of the magazine called Juxtapose,
uh-huh.
Heard that that in 1969, Leary came to a show that just preceded the Woodstock Festival, and he was supposed to be in Folsom Prison, but he was walking around with some guy recording everything he was saying. So he comes into my show, does a once around, and he says, "I love your humor," and then walks off into the middle distance. So Greg, although he knew that Leary was dying of cancer,
mm-hmm.
that he knew where he lived, and so he got us connected, and then so I was just reminiscing with him a little bit, and then I think he died when he got off the phone.
Amazing. You know, for a short period of time, just last year, I did a radio program with Joanna Harcourt Smith, who was his wife and his partner for a long time.
Yeah. I talked to her when she came to Boston and had his book. You know, like somebody in the prison was working on an idea for, you know, for a rocket to go out and come back and they were trying to get people to be the crew of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, to go out and go to Alpha Centauri and mm-hmm. come back.
Right. Yeah. Amazing. All right, well, look, Paul, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. I know it's late, and I tell you, I appreciate it, and so do a whole lot of other people out there listening.
I love to talk like this.
Well, we'll do it again. We've got a whole lot more to talk about for sure. So.
Yeah.
All right?
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
You're more than welcome, and you take care of yourself, and I'll talk to you again, okay?
Okay.
All right, everybody. The wonderful Paul LaFolie. Check him out on the web at LaFolie Archive. That's LaFolie, LaFolieArchive.com. Also at myspace.com/PaulLaFolie. And you can also get to Paul's site anytime now from here on out over at my site at MikeHagan.com. I'll have this program up in the archives in the next 24 hours or so, and you can share it with your friends. Wonderful stuff. And again, thank you. Huge, big time thank you to Paul and to Miguel, Michael Coleman. Thank you so much, Miguel, for putting this whole thing together and helping me out. And also thanks to my friend Julian for introducing me to the musical guest, The Bastard Fairies, tonight, whether you like him or not. And we'll finish out with one more of them. Well, it's Valentine's Day coming up, so... Once again, if you like it or not, The Bastard Fairies. This one's called Ode to the Prostitute. It's Mike. You've been listening to Radio Orbit. Back again next Monday. Don't forget one more time, KOPN on the web, KOPN.org. Help us out. You know what I'm talking about.
children.
Sex. Sex.
We know that once a person is perverted, it is practically impossible for that person to adjust to normal attitudes in regard to sex.
Sex. Sex.